Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Dateline Yuma, Arizona this morning. The leader of the free world took a couple of hours to talk about immigration.
Number of people apprehended for illegally crossing our southern border is down by nearly 30% this year. We're making progress.
Where the president would really like to make some progress, though, is on Capitol Hill. What you just heard is the opening thrust of the new immigration debate. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers to bring about ideas for nourishing the world. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad you could be here today. It's Monday, April 9th. The White House advance team probably didn't have to think too hard before they chose the Border Patrol station in Yuma for the president's speech this morning. Yuma's been a popular choice for illegal immigrants entering the country, and President Bush has been there before. He swung by last May when he announced that he was sending National Guard troops to help patrol the border. Now that Democrats are running Congress, it's possible an immigration bill might actually pass, including item one on the White House wish list, a guest worker program.
It seems to make sense to me that if you got people coming here to do jobs Americans aren't doing, we need to figure out a way that they can do so in a legal basis for a temporary period of time.
At the same time, the administration's been trying to figure out how to get a reform plan passed. It's been toughening up on illegal workers already on the job. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Workplace raids have netted more than 18,000 suspected illegal immigrants since May. That's gotten the attention of U.S. companies. Jack Martin's with the Federation for American Immigration Reform.
The workplace raids that have been conducted have the effect of putting employers on notice that they can't continue to get away with hiring large numbers of illegal aliens.
Companies are starting to police themselves. Since June, there's been a 40% jump in the number of businesses voluntarily participating in Basic Pilot. That's a government program to verify the immigration status of employees. Angela Kelly's with the National Immigration Forum, a group that favors amnesty. She says workplace raids destabilize businesses, and they don't address the broad need for low-cost labor.
We're not ever going to really fix the problem simply by raiding random businesses when you're speaking of such big numbers of 12 million people here, 5% of the U.S. workforce. What it really is going to require is an overhaul of our immigration system.
Everyone agrees on the need to bring undocumented workers out of the shadows. Phil Kent is with Americans for Immigration Control.
Surely in agriculture and in a couple other selected areas, we do need migrant and guest worker programs. We just need to monitor them and to know who these people are and to make sure they're decently treated and get a decent wage.
In the meantime, tighter controls have put the squeeze on industry. Crops are rotting in the fields in Arizona and Colorado due to a shortage of farmhands. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Rumors of the death of the private equity boom are turning out to be greatly exaggerated. Just today, we've got reports of the biggest leverage buyout of all time. The British tabloid The Sunday Express says KKR is interested in buying Dow Chemical for $50 billion. If the name's familiar, KKR, that is, not Dow, it's because just a month or so ago, it announced a deal for the Texas utility TXU for a then-record $32 billion. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports what today's news represents may be more important than the deal itself.
According to the rumor, KKR would team up with other investors to take over Dow Chemical. KKR is not commenting, and Dow says it's not interested in being bought. Though nobody can confirm the particulars of the story, everyone agrees that in concept, at least, it's plausible. Used to be, private equity firms only went after companies that were struggling, snapped them up at bargain prices, took them private, fixed them up, and then took them public again. But private equity firms have been raking in the cash lately and are widening their view of targets. Suddenly, everything is fair game, even very big businesses that aren't really struggling.
And there seem to be very few companies now that buyout firms would not consider approaching.
Maureen Burns edits the trade publication Private Equity Insider. She says these days, private equity is interested in any company that can bring a profit. And they're willing to spend more for it, too. University of Michigan finance professor David Brophy.
There was a time when the general feeling was that there was a kind of ceiling on how big this business could get, but the ceiling keeps being raised.
But with such massive amounts of money at stake, private equity firms are often reluctant to take on all the risk themselves, even if they could afford it, which isn't always the case. In this case, KKR would reportedly team up with a number of Middle Eastern investors to buy Dow. These so-called club deals defray the risk for the investing firms. But, points out Burns, that can mean trouble for those who buy into funds controlled by more than one of the partners.
They end up with a huge amount of exposure to that one particular deal on both the funds that they've bought into.
Of course, she says, that means a double payout if the turnaround is successful. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Pick your favorite brand new movie. Almost doesn't matter what it is. Chances are there's already a bootleg DVD on the streets of Shanghai for just a couple of bucks. Today, for what seems like the umpteenth time, Washington talked tough on Chinese piracy. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports from Washington. The U.S. Trade Representative is set to file two new China complaints with the World Trade Organization.
Despite years of jawboning over China's counterfeit market for books and CDs and DVDs, Trade Representative Susan Schwab says Chinese piracy costs U.S. businesses billions of dollars.
This is more than a handbag here or a logo there. It is often theft on a grand scale. It is not fair, and we must thwart the pirates and counterfeiters who are responsible.
Today's piracy crackdown follows U.S. limits on imports of Chinese paper announced less than 2 weeks ago. This tougher line by Bush administration trade officials is welcomed by Congress and the recording and movie industries, but it's making some businesses that have opened Chinese markets nervous. Some pharmaceutical and software companies worry about retaliation, with good reason, according to intellectual property lawyer Lester Ross in Beijing.
You could see stricter enforcement, for example, at the China's ports with respect to imports from the United States or some other country.
But the president of the U.S.-China Business Council, John Frisby, representing 250 U.S. companies, says trade disputes are normal.
For a commercial relationship that's now as large and complex as ours is with China, we prefer to see dialogue as the preferred means of trying to resolve them. But when that doesn't happen, then we have recourse to things like the WTO to try to get resolution.
Which is why, Frisby says, China's entry into the WTO 5 years ago was so important. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Wall Street was back at work this Monday after a Friday holiday, and not much really happened. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With more students borrowing more money to pay higher tuition bills, student loans have become an $85 billion industry in this country. And where there's that much money on the line, there's always the opportunity for problems. CIT Group announced today the three top officials at its Student Loan Express subsidiary are going to be taking some time off with pay. New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo is looking into possible kickbacks. He's investigating financial ties between lenders and aid officials at several universities, as well as at the U.S. Department of Education. He's already issued a basket full of subpoenas to CIT Group and others, and Congress is promising its own investigation. Commentator Jeff Birnbaum says this might be one area where bipartisanship could actually happen.
Of all the industries under attack on Capitol Hill, and there are plenty of them, the business of providing student loans is perhaps the most endangered. The private student loan industry and its leading company, Sallie Mae, are battling against congressional Democrats and President Bush, both of whom would like to pare back the lenders' sizable federal benefits. The private student loan industry in general, and Sallie Mae in particular, has never been popular with Democrats. Democratic policymakers see the billion-dollar subsidies that go to student lenders as a terrible waste. They've said for years that they'd prefer to take for-profit companies out of the market and encourage student lending directly from Uncle Sam. But this year, in a surprise, Bush broke with the GOP's unwavering support of private lending to students and sided with the Democrats. Republicans have backed the private sector in many areas, including this one. But the president's budget proposal to Congress in February recommended reducing federal subsidies to private lenders and increasing some of their fees for a total savings of $19 billion over 5 years. That's a bigger bite than even Democrats were considering. Why? Well, it seems that both parties have decided that private lenders have been too rich for too long. Executives at places like Sallie Mae have been pulling in millions of dollars a year. In fact, Sallie's chairman, Albert Lord, sold $18 million of company stock just days before Bush proposed the subsidy cuts that caused Sallie Mae's shares to drop. On top of that, investigations are underway about private lenders lining the pockets of student loan officers to get preferential treatment. Without question, private lending of student loans is about to change, and it seems that almost everyone agrees that it's well past time for that to happen.
Jeff Birnbaum is a columnist for The Washington Post. Your thoughts? Marketplace.org is our website. Click on that link that says contact. Today is Easter Monday, just another working day in this country. Over in the UK, though, it's the tail end of the four-day Easter weekend. It's a fair bet most of the faithful haven't been thinking about parish finances as they've been attending services, but dozens of churches and cathedrals throughout England are facing uncertain financial futures. They've been running out space to earn some spare change, but Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from London, higher-ups are unimpressed.
Church towers are lofty in every sense. They point heavenwards, they summon the faithful to worship and prayer, but in recent years they've been involved in a less spiritual form of communication.
But Church Spire is a wonderful place to put an antenna. It's because it's very tall, and also there aren't a lot of people living in the building to complain.
Science writer Barry Fox. More than 50 English churches are renting out their steeples to cell phone companies for up to $20,000 a year. A godsend for the churches, which are often in urgent need of repair, says Jonathan Peter, religion correspondent of the Daily Telegraph.
A lot of them are medieval, and of course it costs a huge amount to keep them up, let alone in good shape. The cathedrals, of course, are even in worse state, and a lot of them have buckets catching the rain coming through the roof.
Let us go forth in peace, praising Jesus our Messiah.
But the mini deluge of cash from the cell phone companies is causing strife and discord. Congregation of St. Peter and St. Paul Church in North London. The church's vicar wanted to have a cell phone mast installed in his steeple, but some parishioners objected. The matter was referred to an ecclesiastical court, and, says Jonathan Peter, the judge made an unexpected ruling.
He said pornography can be transmitted through mobile phones, and that the church's mission was to promote the church's work. Putting up mobile phone masts which could transmit pornography was outside that legal remit.
Yes, the judge decided that while the church bells were summoning the faithful to prayer, the cell phone mast inside the tower might be conveying a set of rather different signals.
You have called the filthiest and most explicit telephone sex service in the UK. I must warn you that if you are easily offended by explicit adult material, you must hang up now.
The judge said that the original concept of mobile phones was totally innocent, but they could now be used to download vast quantities of obscene material. He banned St. Peter and St. Paul from installing the mast. The views from the pews are mixed.
We're unhappy with the idea.
For the reason that the possibility of pornography. It just doesn't seem appropriate to have things like this in a church, is my feeling.
I've got a mobile phone. I use a mobile phone. I can't use it without a mast somewhere.
Why not in a church spire?
Why not in a church spire where it's hidden? You can't see it. It's not a blot on the landscape. and earn some revenue for the church.
What about the argument that mobile phones could be used to download pornography and that would be inappropriate for a church spy?
I'm 87 and I never think of those sort of things.
This may not prove a laughing matter for the Church of England. The case is now under appeal, but if the banning order is upheld, it could deprive the church of an important new source of income.
The Lord be with you.
The Reverend Simon Heans would like to have seen a mast in the steeple of his church in South London. He thinks the court decision is frankly ridiculous, even though he is worried about pornography.
Pornography per se worries me, but the issue of using mobile phones for that purpose is neither here nor there because, of course, it can be transmitted in all sorts of ways.
You're one-to-one with an experienced woman is about to begin. Get ready.
Indeed. This message arrived down an ordinary fixed telephone line that could easily have travelled across church property. With thousands of dollars at stake, church leaders await the appeal court's decision with trepidation, hoping and praying for those pennies from heaven. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up...
It's R2-D2.
No, actually, it's an alarm clock. We'll tell you about it in a minute, but first, let's do the numbers. Upbeat news on corporate takeovers and a big drop in oil prices ended up being balanced out by fears of a disappointing round of profit reports. That kept the stock market very near the status quo for most of the day. In the end, the Dow picked up 8 points, not quite a tenth of 1%, to close at 12,569. The Nasdaq shaved off 2 points, that's a tenth percent, ending at 2469. The S&P 500 edged up a fraction of a point to wrap up the day at 1444. If you're keeping track, it was the seventh straight trading day on the upside for the Dow, and both the Blue Chip Index and the S&P 500 have now recovered all the ground they lost in that sell-off back at the end of February. Investors were making tracks for railroad stocks today with a not-so-locomotive. They were chasing after Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, which disclosed it's bought stakes in three rail companies. It's now top shareholder of Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, and the news fired up that stock by 6.5%. No official word on the other two companies that Berkshire has trained its sights on. Sorry about that. Couldn't help it. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, managing investments for the long term with a consistent, disciplined approach. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. 1-877-T-ROWE-PRICE. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Ever hear a song on Marketplace, but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to the Public Radio Music Source, where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Tuesday. President Bush speaks on the Iraq War Supplemental Appropriations Bill. The Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee convenes a hearing on voice-over internet protocol and the future of 911 services. And a brilliant aid to garments and well-appointed fashionistas everywhere was patented on April 10th, 1849. We can thank inventor Walter Hunt for the safety pin and for keeping us safe from getting stuck. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. OPEC might soon find itself with a little competition. Won't have such a catchy name, though. Try GPCF on for size. Gas Producing Countries Forum. The gas in question is natural, not the stuff you put in your car. The world's largest natural gas exporters are meeting today in the Persian Gulf state of Qatar. They've got plans afoot to work together to set prices, which sounds a lot like a cartel, although Qatar's energy minister said today he hates that word. Vijay Vaitheeswaran is a correspondent for The Economist. Vijay, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Is there something that you would say there is about the natural gas market, the way it works, the way the product is brought to market, that makes a cartel either easier or more difficult than in the oil industry?
Sure. I mean, the reason people are interested in this idea about a gas cartel is that there are a few countries, Russia, Qatar, in particular, Iran, most notably and vociferously, that want to gain some power over the marketplace. But the problem is, from their perspective, gas is not oil. And of course, everyone would have heard of the OPEC cartel, the oil mm-hmm. cartel. I'm very skeptical when it comes to talk about creating a gas cartel for the following reasons. There's a lot more gas left in the world than there is oil. And not only that, it's much more dispersed among many more countries. So that makes it harder for any two or three countries to try to create a cartel, to try to limit production. So it's just a much harder market to create a cartel in natural gas is.
What about the physical manifestation of the market? Is it different than oil in how the product gets to market?
That's another aspect of why I think a cartel talk is a little wishful thinking on the part of Russia, perhaps, and Iran. Most gas is still delivered by pipeline, very long pipeline sometimes, such as those from Russia to Western Europe. And whereas most oil, indeed, almost all of the internationally traded oil, is delivered on tankers. And why does that matter? And that's because a ship at sea can be redirected very easily, whereas gas that's put into a pipeline, like a Russian gas pipeline going towards Western Europe, well, if you decide, for example, to do an embargo on your customer or something like that, you can't redirect that gas anywhere else. It's not very easy to do because that gas is piped. So there's a fundamental structural issue in the marketplace that reduces the power of producers, in my judgment. And so I think that's another reason why efforts by gas producers to exercise their producer power, whether through cartels or embargoes, in my judgment, will always fail over the long run.
All right, so what we have here is a product, a commodity that does not lend itself to being cartelized, if you will, if I could create a word, and countries that are, or at least seem to be, of mixed minds whether or not they want to work together to make their product power stick in the marketplace. Is this then just a conversation about political power based on the high price of energy?
Absolutely. When you see prices go up in commodity markets, particularly for oil and gas, you see a lot of hubris in producing countries. You see, you know, what economists have known for a long time as the oil curse or natural resources curse, that you see if you look at Venezuela with Hugo Chavez, Russia with Vladimir Putin. When countries, and particularly nationalistic, very strong leaders, have access to lots and lots of easy money, that's which is really what oil and gas is, you find that they suddenly become very forceful with their foreign policies. They try to use energy pricing in a way that enhances national security. The problem is energy prices are cyclical. What goes up often comes down. What goes down may go up again. But the promises that are made by Chavez, for example, in Venezuela or Vladimir Putin, they're making a lot of promises in terms of government spending. They're making a lot of flexing of muscles, I should say, in terms of foreign policy. Well, if the oil and gas prices trend down dramatically in coming years, they might actually find that those promises come to nothing or worse, that there's a great deal of disillusionment in their countries.
Vijay Vaitheeswaran is a correspondent for The Economist magazine. His book on the energy industry is called Power to the People. Vijay, thanks a lot for your time.
It's a pleasure.
We had a story on last year about an alarm clock, not just any alarm clock, Clocky's, an alarm with wheels. It rolls off the bedside table after you hit the snooze button, so not only do you have to get out of bed to turn it off, you actually have to chase it down. Back then, it was just a prototype wrapped in what looked like shag carpeting. Well, Clocky's all grown up now and on the market. Marketplace's Sean Cole brings us up to date on the morning torture device that can't be stopped.
This is what Clocky sounded like 2 years ago in the MIT Media Lab.
Well, it's like trying to make love to my tape recorder here.
And it didn't work too well. In fact, Gauri Nanda, the MIT Marquis de Grad student who invented Clocky, couldn't even get it to roll off the table like it was supposed to. She had to push it.
Oh, it just stopped.
You know, I think the battery popped out. That's probably why it's causing trouble.
So when I visited Clocky again at Nanda's apartment in Boston the other day,
hello.
It was like going to a distant cousin's bar mitzvah.
Yeah. And here he is.
Yeah,
look! Oh my gosh!
The shag is gone, replaced by sleek plastic that comes in three colors.
Well, we call this aqua, mint, and then like an almond white.
It looks like a cannon mount. The wheels on either side are bigger than the body, so it easily survives the drop to the floor. And this is what Clocky sounds like now.
It's R2-D2.
Exactly.
Its creator is kind of all grown up, too. After graduating from the media lab, Nanda started her own company.
It's called Nanda.
Surprise. And with about $100,000 from her family, she plunged into the deep end of entrepreneurship without water wings.
Because, of course, my background was in design and technology, so you really can't underestimate the marketing and the sales. That's, you know, once you have a product and it's designed, you know, the work has really just begun, so.
And when she first launched Clocky on the internet the week before Christmas, the biggest challenge was just getting enough of them made.
Yeah, a lot of people wanted it at that point. At that point, we didn't have, you know, that much in stock. So, you know, we tried to fulfill as many orders as we could, but.
But you couldn't fulfill all of them?
No, it was much more demand at that point than we could handle.
Still, she's managed to sell about 5,000 of the little guys so far. And at $50 a pop, that's more than double her initial investment. But then each of them costs about $17 to manufacture in China, and she has to pay a couple of people helping her part-time. And finally, I just asked her point blank. How much money can I borrow?
Well, you know, we are a startup company, so actually
So you're not rich yet?
I'm not rich yet.
Damn. And I should point out that money wasn't her only motivation. She also wanted to make her own hours, because she likes to sleep late. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. And by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, a penny more per pound. That's what McDonald's will pay migrant farm workers for the Florida-grown tomatoes that they harvest. A coalition of vegetable pickers has been fighting for the increase for about 2 years now. By some estimates, tomato pickers are currently paid around 40 cents per 32-pound bucket of fruit, no benefits. Do the math, the raise almost doubles their wages to about 77 cents a bucket, and it conveniently lets McDonald's avoid protests in front of company headquarters. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow picked up 8 points, not quite a tenth of 1%, as investors wait for earnings season to start tomorrow. The Nasdaq fell 2 points, less than a tenth of 1% change there as well. The S&P 500 gained a fraction of a point. We'll call that one basically flat. Our producers include Jane Lindholm, Brett Neely, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time, the list you really don't want to be on.
Okay, so you want to become an opponent of Chavez? You'll become an opponent of Chavez, but that's going to have a high cost. You're not going to have a job.
Politics and personal economics in Venezuela. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.